This is episode number 47 with deep learning expert Hadelan de Pontevez. Welcome to the Super Data Science Podcast. My name is Kirill Eremenko, data science coach and lifestyle entrepreneur. And each week we bring you inspiring people and ideas to help you build your successful career in data science. Thanks for being here today, and now let's make the complex simple. Welcome everybody back to the Super Data Science Podcast. Super excited to have you on board. And today, by popular demand, we have a returning guest, Hadelan de Pontevez. Hadelan was on the show for the first time about 6 months ago. That was episode 2, and that was when we just released the Machine Learning A to Z course. And now he's back, and this time we've just released the Deep Learning A to Z course. And so what is deep learning all about? Well, deep learning is an advanced branch of machine learning where we use algorithms called neural networks to mimic the human brain in order to be able to solve very complex problems. And our goal with Hadelan in creating Deep Learning A to Z was to create a course that has a robust structure and really covers topics in a simple manner that is accessible to anybody. So you don't have to be an expert in mathematics or in programming or in anything else for that matter. Just you need a basic background in high school maths to understand this course and to follow along. And that's what exactly what we created. It's released now, and it was actually also featured on Kickstarter, where it had immense support from backers, and we're very excited about that. We're very excited to bring this course to the world. And today we're going to run through all of the 6 different models that we discuss in the course and give you a quick breakdown. And finally, for those of you who don't know Hadelan, I wanted to mention that Hadelan has experience in deep learning from Canal Plus, which is a competitor of Netflix, and as well as that, Google. So this is definitely a person who knows his way around deep learning, and we're going to learn quite a lot in today's podcast. So I'm very excited for you to hear this episode and get your glimpse into the world of deep learning and the different models that exist there. And without further ado, I bring to you Hadelan de Pontevez. Welcome everybody, and welcome Hadelan back to the show. How are you going, my friend?
I'm doing very well. Thank you. I'm very happy to be back.
Awesome. Well, you definitely should be, because 12,000 views. As of today, your podcast, your first episode, has 12,000 views. How do you feel about that?
Wow. That's amazing. I didn't expect that many views. So yeah, I'm very happy about that. And I hope this has helped some people, and that people could be inspired from it.
Yeah, I definitely hope so too, and I'm actually sure of it. And it's raised some very interesting debates, especially the podcast was about machine learning, but what raised debates was your health, since you mentioned you were sleeping 3 hours a day for the past 3 years. And
I know, right? Some people were concerned. Yeah. I got message on LinkedIn to tell me that I should be careful, and thank you very much for all of them.
Yeah, that was fantastic. And everybody worried about Hadelan out there. He's still alive. He's still fine. And as always, very energetic. Yeah. So, mate, what have you been up to, or what have we been up to over the past couple of months? What project have we been working on?
Well, we made the deep learning course.
Yeah.
The big brother of the machine learning course. So, yeah, this one is, I think, more powerful, because we dive deep into some more advanced techniques, and we code some more advanced stuff, like we use classes and objects, you know, to implement some deep learning models from scratch. So I think it is quite new, and people will still improve a lot of their skills even after doing the machine learning course. So I think it's very complementary. And it's basically taking things at the next level.
Exactly. And also, I wanted to point out here that our goal was to create the most disruptive course on deep learning and really collate a lot of information from pretty much everywhere, and putting our knowledge and experience into this course and our view on things, and put together, most importantly, not just one, not just two, not just three, but six different models on deep learning. And I think we finally can say that we have completed this course and it's there and people are going through it and we're very, very excited about it.
Yes, and actually I finished implementing the very last model of this course yesterday. It was the Boltzmann machine, which took 14 tutorials. And I was really happy to finish it because it was quite a challenge. Because this is one of the most advanced model in this course, because it's a probabilistic graphical model, you know, so it handles a lot of probabilities. And we had to dive into the MCMC, Markov chain Monte Carlo techniques, with Gibbs sampling, with the random walk. So a lot of very cool mathematical concepts. But, we did it yesterday and I was very happy to finish on that note.
Fantastic. And congrats on that. It was definitely a big course to tackle. And for everybody listening, today we're going to talk about deep learning. This podcast is dedicated to deep learning and summarizing and running through all the things that we have covered in the course. And just to give you, even if you're not taking the course, just to give you a feel and taste for what deep learning is about, what type of models exist out there, what type of approaches, techniques, what are the use cases and applications. And so we'll be running through six different models of deep learning, giving you our comments on that. And it's going to be quite an exciting podcast. Really looking forward to the session. How about you, mate? Are you excited about this?
Yeah, very excited.
All right. Okay. So let's kick things off with the very first, very basic model, the artificial neural networks, right? It goes into the foundation of all of the deep learning kind of concepts and principles and outlines everything there. And probably we'll start off by saying that in artificial neural networks, if you're listening to this podcast and if you haven't taken the course yet, then probably you should know that in this course, as just like in the machine learning course, I was doing the intuition tutorials and Hadlan was doing the practical application tutorial. So you might hear us comment on the deep learning methodologies from both sides exactly in that manner. And in terms of artificial neural networks, we're trying to model the human brain. So we're creating this structure which is full of neurons which are interconnected. And the fascinating thing, like just by creating this course, I personally learned a lot, especially about the field of neuroscience. I found out that in the brain, we have 100 billion different neurons, and each one of them is connected to at least as many as 1,000 other neighbors. And so just wanted to get your comment on that, Hadlan. What are modern deep learning neural networks like? Are there anywhere close that size?
Well, at least that's our goal. We are trying to build some models that mimic the processes in the human brain. But of course, we're not there today. As you said, there are a billion of neurons in the human brain, and there are lots of connections between the neurons. So far, when we talk about artificial deep learning, like the artificial neural networks we make when we solve some problems, well, they contain like several, maybe dozens of layers at most. So we're very far from what's happening in the brain, but we're trying to mimic what's happening in the brain. We're trying to reproduce the structure, the connections, and by adding, of course, some mathematics into it, to make some relevant models that can solve complex problems with lots of nonlinear relationships. And only only models that are close to how the brain works can solve that kind of problems.
Okay, and why is that? That's actually a good segue into what's the whole point of deep learning? Why can't we just stick to machine learning and solve all our problems with machine learning?
Because basically there's limitations in machine learning. In machine learning, we can solve a lot of problems, but when the problems become very complex, because problems are defined by their relationships, whether they are linear, nonlinear, how complex are the nonlinear relationships. And when we are reaching some high level of complexities, well, because with deep learning we can, extend the complexity by adding some layers and some neurons, well, we can basically solve more and more complex problems. Thanks to the fact we can, add these layers and these neurons. With machine learning, well, you have some fixed models. You know, you cannot really extend the models of machine learning. Well, you could, for example, for XGBoost, and XGBoost is actually another great model that is used to solve very complex problems. But that is because you can add some trees in XGBoost, because XGBoost is like a random forest, but in a much more advanced construction. So that's the thing. You can add some level of complexities by adding some trees or layers in the models, and that's how deep learning can solve complex problems as opposed to machine learning.
Okay, gotcha. So basically, at some point you reach a level of complexity. For example, recognizing objects in an image, that's pretty complex, right? And
yes,
yeah, not just recognizing objects from an algorithm which tells you look for this type of pixel, looks for this type of pixel, but automatically learning how to recognize objects from many thousands of images, that's a complex problem.
That's right. That's a very complex problem. Not only you have to understand some patterns in thousands and thousands of images, but also you have to understand some patterns in the pixels. Mm-hmm. And there are thousands and thousands of pixels. So mm-hmm. That makes the problem really, really complex. And of course, this is not solvable with machine learning, classic machine learning.
Okay. All right. Gotcha. And so going back to ANNs, we introduced a couple of concepts there, and I know it's going to be extremely, like, the course is what is it, how long, 20 hours or something so far?
Yeah, a little more than 20 hours. We are going to add some more tutorials.
Yeah, and so it's going to be extremely hard to convey some of these topics in the podcast, but just quickly, we introduced a few concepts, and probably the key one is the activation function. What happens in the activation function? Can you tell us a bit about that?
Okay, so first of all, there are different kinds of activation functions. There are different activation functions. We have the rectifier activation function that is used to break the linearity, because that's the whole point of it. We are trying to solve nonlinear problems. In order to be able to solve these nonlinear problems, we have to break the linearity between one hidden layer to another hidden layer. And that's what the rectifier function is for. And actually, you explained very well in one of your intuition lectures. And then we have the sigmoid activation function, which is another kind of activation function that is used to output the predictions in terms of probabilities. Instead of returning an exact outcome, for example, a binary outcome 0 or 1, you will use the activation function to model the probability of an outcome. So, for example, that will return 0.8, meaning that the outcome will have 80% of being the right prediction, 80% chance of being the right prediction. And then you have some other activation functions, but basically the idea of an activation function is to activate the neuron. That's used to activate certain neurons in the neural networks with certain weight, and the higher is the weight, the higher, the more relevant will be the neuron.
Yeah, gotcha. And that is very similar to what's going on in the human brain, that well, in our brains, right? As we're just talking now, what's going on is neurons are firing up. They're sending an electrical impulse to the following neuron. And then that neuron is getting electrical impulses from many different neurons around it, so up to 1,000 different neurons. It's combining all of that. It's making a decision whether it needs to fire up or not, and then it's passing on or not an electrical signal of varying intensity to the next neuron, and so on. So when you combine all of that, you have this whole huge army of neurons sending around electrical signals, and that is what thought is. That is what all of these ideas that we have, all of these concepts and our visual, our interaction with the world, all of our senses, they all translate into that. And it's fascinating when you think about it, that all the thoughts that we have are just basically electrical signals running around in our heads.
That's right. Yes, it's fascinating, and it's fascinating that we're managing to reproduce that with models that we make ourselves.
Yeah, totally. So that's very important that we mention that. So we have neurons in the artificial neural networks, and we have activation functions which kind of connect the neurons and facilitate the interaction between the neurons. And then in a artificial neural network, we have three types of layers. Tell us about that. We have what layers do we have? Okay. In the ANN?
So Of course, let's start with the input layer. Mm-hmm. The input layer is the layer that receives the observations. So, for example, let's give an example. So, for example, let's say we're trying to predict if some customers are going to leave or stay in a company or leave or stay a bank. Well, the input layer would get the information of the customers that will go through the network to be able to then make some predictions. So that's the input layer that just receives the observations. And then we have the hidden layers, and that's where everything happens. That's where the learning happens. That's where the model is trying to learn how to make some correlations between the information of the input layer and the output, which is the final prediction. And this final prediction is going to be compared to the real outcome, and that's how the model is going to learn, because it's going to compare the prediction to the real outcome, and according to the mistake it might make, well, it will correct what happened before, and that's backpropagation. In backpropagation, then it will correct the weights so that it can learn some better correlations next time. And so, yeah, so after the hidden layers, we have the output layer that gets the final prediction.
And the more hidden layers we add, the more complex becomes our neural network. It's harder to train, but it might be able to solve more complex problems. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. Yes.
Okay. And you mentioned a couple of interesting terms. So first of all, if I'm not familiar with neural networks, I might ask the question, what is the purpose of building a neural network if on the output you're comparing the result to the real outcome? So that means you already have the real outcome. What's the whole point of modeling an outcome? Can you comment on that?
Sure. Well, that's because for any machine learning model or any deep learning model, well, there is a training phase and a testing phase. In order for the model to learn something, it needs the real outcomes to learn the correlations. Because if it didn't have the real outcomes, it couldn't learn anything, right? It's like when a student is practicing for an exam, is learning a lesson or a topic. Well, it needs the real outcome when it's training, so that it can evaluate how he understood the course. Well, that's the same for a deep learning model. It needs a training phase with real outcomes so that it can make some predictions itself, but then it has to compare these predictions to the real outcomes so that it can correct itself. And then we have the test set. And on the test set, we have some totally new observations for which we don't have the real outcomes. And this is what pure predictions are about. This is really pure predictions. We don't have anything to compare them.
All right, gotcha. And in this case, when we actually compare to the real outcomes, so some models train with the real outcomes, some models still train but without the real outcomes. And the two different ones are called supervised models and unsupervised models. So artificial neural networks are a type of supervised model. And in total, we looked at three different supervised models and looked at three different unsupervised models. And probably the last comment is on backpropagation. So you'll be hearing the word backpropagation quite a lot. It is relevant to supervised deep learning models. And basically, in summary, it's exactly what Hadlan described. You compare to the real output, you find the error, and then you backpropagate, hence the name backpropagation. You backpropagate that error through the network to update the network in very simplistic terms, and that's how the models train. So that was artificial neural networks. Let's move on to number two, convolutional neural networks. So CNNs, what are they used for?
Okay, so CNNs are mainly used for image detection. Mm-hmm. But they have variant other applications like text recognition. Image detection, how does it work? Well, the CNNs are going to try to learn something, like some patterns in the pixels. And that's how they will detect some specific features in the images to be able, in the end, to recognize what is in the image. So, for example, in our course, we're training an algorithm, a CNN actually, that is a learning to predict whether there is a cat or a dog in images. And so to do this, it will try to understand some patterns in the pixels of the images to detect some specific features of dogs and the specific features of cats. And that's how in the end it can manage to predict if there is a cat or a dog in the image.
Yeah, and the most fascinating thing for me is that it can learn that and we got a pretty good accuracy rate in the course. It can learn, you know, whether it's a cat or a dog just by looking at lots and lots of images. How many images did we have in the course?
10,000.
10,000.
So we're training the CNN on 8,000 images.
Yep.
And we're testing it on 2,000 images. And indeed, on the 2,000 images, we get a pretty good accuracy. That is a pretty good correct predictions.
What is it like?
I think we reach 82%.
82% accuracy.
Yes.
Which is great, right? So it means that the CNN had a look at 8,000 images of dogs or cats, which are labeled. So it knows that in this folder has cats, and this folder has dogs. It just looked through them without anything else. No tricks or hacks were specified, nothing. We just said, look at these images. These are cats, these are dogs, and now decide for yourself what is important for you in an image. What features are you going to be looking for when you're looking at new images to decide whether it's a dog or a cat? And then after all the training, we gave it 2,000 images of dogs and cats. And out of those 2,000, it got 85% correct. So it identified 85% of the images correctly, that these are dogs, cats, without us having to tell it how to do it. It learned the thing itself.
Yes, that's right. And these are our new observations, new images. And besides, this is without any parameter tuning, because in the course we insist on parameter tuning. And that's one of the homeworks we gave to the students. That is, we let the students work on the model to improve them, tune them. And actually, one of the challenges to get 90% accuracy, which I know is possible. So that's why I gave the challenge. And for the students who managed to reach that 90% accuracy, they will have the gold medal.
Well, has anybody gotten 90% accuracy yet?
Somebody got the gold medal on the other challenge, which is for ANN.
Okay.
Actually, that was today, so I congratulated that student.
Okay.
He got 87% accuracy, which is very good on the other problem.
Oh, I think I saw that message, and his accuracy was even better than in the training set. On the test set, it was higher than on the training set.
Absolutely, that's the one.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, gotcha. All right, very cool. So that was CNN's very brief intro into convolutional networks. And CNNs are very important, and it's very important to understand the concepts behind CNN, because that is not in its raw form what goes into self-driving cars, but that is the direction in which things like self-driving cars are aiming. That's they need to recognize pedestrians on streets, they need to recognize stop signs, they need to recognize the color of the traffic light to work completely autonomously. And that is your first step in that direction. So would you say that's a fair summary?
Yeah, that's absolutely a fair summary. Of course, CNNs are used in self-driving cars to detect objects on the street, which is absolutely compulsory.
Yeah, and there was actually a challenge to see how well computers can do to detect, to recognize different types of road signs. And right now, they're already doing better than humans. It's really interesting. All right, moving on to the next one, recurrent neural networks.
Oh, that was quite a challenge.
Yeah, for us, we spent so much time on recurrent neural networks, simply because of the challenge that we set ourselves. We wanted to predict stock prices, but in the end we found out that it's too chaotic to predict with recurrent neural networks. Well, to the extent that we attempted that challenge. So probably if you spend more time, you might be able to find ways to do it better. But nevertheless, very interesting type of recurrent neural network. This is a neural network that has short-term memory. So all neural networks have long-term memory, and that's when you train them up, they remember the structure and the configuration of the neural network will remember the training, and then it will apply that knowledge in the testing, and hence it can recognize dogs or cats or perform solve complex problems. But recurrent neural networks actually have short-term memory, which allow it to if it's going through a data set in row 51, it will remember what the outcomes were for row 50, row 49, or 48, and so on. And what kind of applications does that open up for the world of deep learning?
Well, there are many applications. There are applications, for example, for natural language processing. You can use recurrent neural networks for natural language processing if you want to predict what's going to be the next step in a sequence of text. So you can, for example, predict what's going to be the last word in a sentence and more. So more you can increase the complexity of the problem. And it can also be used for video classification. For example, if you want to predict what's going to happen next in a video, and then in that case, you will need to combine convolutional neural networks to RNN, because basically RNN are used to predict a time series, like what's going to be the next step in a series of events. So that can be used for text, as I said, or for videos as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, gotcha. So RNNs are very often used in combination with other algorithms like CNNs. You can train up an RNN to basically just go through like a whole huge amount of text and like learn from it how sentences are structured, how words follow each other. And that way you train up a deep learning model to create sentences in essence. And in the course, we actually mention a small video, like a 9-minute film called Sunspring, which was entirely written by an RNN, specifically an LSTM, so long short-term memory type of RNN, which was trained up on thousands of sci-fi films, and then it wrote its own sci-fi film, and people actually acted it out, professional actors acted it out, and it participated in the, I think it was a London Sci-Fi London Film Festival, and was rated, I think it was in the top 10. So that's pretty exciting. That's where the world is going. Yeah, so
that's a pretty exciting application.
Yeah, and you can think of lots of other applications. Basically, RNNs are there to facilitate the short-term memory, which we humans have. It's so powerful. We don't just have long-term memory. That if you just had long-term memory, then you wouldn't remember the start of this podcast, and it would be very sad. You'd be sitting there thinking, what are we talking about? What is this whole topic right now? So it's very important. Short-term memory is a very important tool that we have as humans, and therefore, why would we deprive deep learning models of that concept? And that's why RNNs exist. And probably the last thing on RNNs that I wanted to mention here is LSTMs. Can you tell us a bit about LSTMs? What is this? This is actually a huge breakthrough for the world of RNNs. What is it all about?
Yeah, this is actually the disruption in RNNs, because, as you said, RNNs, the classic RNNs have a short memory, mm-hmm. but the LSTM is the first RNN to be able to learn long-term relationships. So basically, it's the first RNN to have long memory. And that's why it is called LSTM, long short-term memory. And so basically, that's the most powerful RNN model, and that's the one we implement in our course.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, it's it was, I think it was created in Germany in the 90s.
Yes, 1997 or something.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it's pretty cool. And actually, it's very interesting. Throughout the course, we mentioned the creators of these models and people who came up with them. And so we've got Jeffrey Hinton, we've got Jan LeCun, Yosha Benjo, and all of these scientists, I think they're all from Canada, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, Jan LeCun is French.
Jan LeCun is French. Okay, that's right. But now they live in Canada slash America. And so they have their own little circle, which I think Jan LeCun calls the conspiracy of deep learning. And it's very interesting. And then all of a sudden you have somebody from Germany creating the LSTM. And for me, when I found out about them, where the LSTMs came from, it was a pleasant surprise that the whole world is actually contributing to this movement. It was great.
Yes.
Okay, so next we are moving into the world of unsupervised deep learning. So first of all, can you tell us a bit about unsupervised? What does that mean, unsupervised?
Well, unsupervised means that basically you don't have the outcome. You don't have an outcome to compare your prediction to. And so basically what you have to do is identify yourself some structure in the data that will become your future predictions. So basically when we're starting with unsupervised learning, we don't have a dependent variable. We don't have something that we want to explain. Mm-hmm. But by identifying some segments or some clusters or some structures in the data, we will eventually end up with such a dependent variable. And actually, in the course, we highlight this transition from unsupervised to supervised, because once we complete our unsupervised deep learning model, we end up with a dependent variable that can lead our model to become a supervised deep learning model.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's definitely a very powerful thing. And unsupervised models, I think they're more complex generally because each one of the models that we discuss has its own very unique approach to learning, like a kind of a trick or a hack or a whole new concept that it introduces in order to bypass the fact that it doesn't have this output to compare to. And we start off by talking about SOMs, so self-organizing maps. Neural networks were created in 1982 by Tuvo Kohonen, a Finnish professor, and they are very interesting. By far, they're the simplest. They're the simplest out of the whole course, just because they're so elegant and the idea behind them is so straightforward. So even the mathematics and the other parts of the course, we don't talk about mathematics in the course. We don't go deep into the mathematics so we don't get bogged down. But the mathematics driving the other models in the course, they're pretty complex. But for self-organizing maps, they're very straightforward. They're very easy to code even from scratch. And we talk about self-organizing maps, and we find out how exactly they work. So what can you tell us about SOMs, Hadlan?
Okay, so first, what is the purpose of SOMs? Well, it's to detect some features in a very complex data. Mm-hmm. That is a high-dimensional data set, again, full of nonlinear relationships. Well, it will detect some features which we have absolutely no idea what they are at the beginning, but it will detect some features inside this data. And how will it do that? Well, it will do that by reducing the dimensionality of the data set. So that's why at the beginning we start with a lot of features that are, our columns in the data set and a lot of observations. And eventually we end up having this two-dimensional map. And on this two-dimensional map, we can see some neurons that we call the winning nodes. And basically each cluster or even each winning node is detecting a certain feature. And so that's pretty powerful because even by having at the beginning a very complex data set, we end up with this cool two-dimensional map that is very visual and that we can use directly to detect some specific features or see some specific clusters, segments in the data set. And actually, we implement a self-organizing map to detect frauds, and that's because the fraud is a specific feature detected by the SOM.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's a very visual type of algorithm.
It's very visual.
So you might have a huge data set with lots and lots of columns, which there's no way you would be able to visualize in a concise way. But then the SOM allows you to reduce that, put it on a map, and then you can see all of the connections. And we actually walk through in the intuition side of things, we walk through a application of SOMs to the, I think it's the U.S. Senate or something. So part of the United States government, how they vote. You can see how they're all plotted in a self-organizing map, and then you can see how to read that map and understand what it's saying about how they're voting, Republicans versus Democrats, and so on. But in our practical tutorials, we actually have a very interesting application. So tell us a bit more. What did you prepare for us in the practical side of things to kind of showcase how SOMs can be used?
Yes. Okay, so the data set contains some credit card applications, some customers, well, some not yet customers, but some people applying to have an advanced credit card in their bank. And basically, to apply for this credit card, they need to fill in a paper and provide a lot of information, like their credit score or other type of financial information, or like their estimated salary. And basically, at the end of the application, there is a yes or no whether they got approved for the credit card. And of course, like in any applications, there are some people that can cheat. And the goal of the problem, the goal is to find the potential cheaters, like to detect the potential fraud in the applications. And so we have no idea how to visualize that at the beginning, because we have a lot of informations, all the informations that were filled in by the customers. But the sum will manage to detect the frauds by detecting some specific features in the self-organizing map. And so I'm not going to say right now what are going to be the features in the sum, because it is actually something that students have to guess at some point. But these features, these frauds, are pretty specific, are pretty visual in the self-organizing map, so we can really well identify them.
Yeah, and I found that was a very cool application of self-organizing maps. Like when you came up with that challenge for the course, I was very excited, because I've worked with fraud analytics before, back when I was at Deloitte, but I've never actually seen self-organizing maps applied to solve the problem. And I think this approach is very interesting, because it does allow you to go through lots and lots of data without having to supervise the model, without having to come up with these inputs at the start, and therefore it can find out. It's really funny. It's like a robot or a computer looking for like people who have committed fraud. It's what are a human's chances against a machine? Zero, right?
Zero.
Pretty much zero. And
let's hope this doesn't go too far.
Yeah, let's hope it doesn't turn into World War III or something like that.
Exactly.
Yeah. And in terms of SOMs, what I found when I was creating the intuition tutorials, that I found that SOMs are actually, personally, they're very different to all the other five models that we discussed. And I would never have thought of classifying them as a deep learning model. I would have thought of, SOMs are just a type of dimensionality reduction, a model. They don't have that whole, I think the lack of backpropagation or the lack of more interconnectivity between neurons makes me kind of think that in some way they're just a bit even too simple to be considered as a deep learning model. What are your thoughts on that? Is it like, is it maybe just because they're so elegant that they give you this impression?
Well, first of all, I agree with you. I had sort of the same feeling when I started studying about SOMs. With no hesitation, I wanted to include them in the course, because they actually involve neurons. The points in the grid are actually neurons, and the neurons are attracting other neurons around them according to how they are similar to these neurons. So, of course, these are very different from the other neural networks that we implement in the course, but this is still a neural network, but in two dimensions, having several neurons. So
yep,
it's considered as a neural network, and that's why it's considered as deep learning. But you're definitely right that this might be the most simple deep learning model in all these neural networks.
Gotcha. But even saying that it's simple, the applications are massive. Maybe the simplicity,
yes,
facilitates more application. Like we briefly mentioned a paper in the course about how photometric redshifts are. SOMs are used to analyze the probability density function of photometric redshifts. So basically, an application in astronomy. Then we look at an example of how it's applied to World Bank data to look at different countries and their prosperity or poverty, and then plot that on a map, then plot that on a actual world map. So applications are immense, limitless for self-organizing maps, and maybe that has something to do with the simplicity.
That's right.
But moving on, next one, our favorite, or probably your favorite algorithm, the Boltzmann machine. So the, by far, hands down, the most complex algorithm that exists on this planet. It was so much fun preparing tutorials. Well, for me anyway, I know that you did 14 tutorials about Boltzmann machine and spent like over a week on that, just recording.
I was very excited.
Yeah, how did that go? Tell us about Boltzmann machines. What are they all about?
Well, first of all, they're very broad. Like, the most important thing is that this is a disruption. This is a rupture between what we had before, because what we had before were sequential models, you know, with a sequence of layers. Mm. We started with the input layer, and then we had a sequence of hidden layers, and then eventually the output layer. And here, that's totally different. We now have some neurons, and all the neurons are connected to each other, and there is no longer input neurons and output and an output layer. So actually, what happens is that we have some visible nodes and some hidden nodes, and this is basically the graph, because that becomes a computational graph. The graph is updating itself, and the input nodes are getting updated, so that they become, in the end, the output nodes, but there is no output layer. So it's like a graph full of probabilities, because basically Boltzmann machines are probabilistic graphical models. And this is a graph that is updating itself. And in the end, it's maximizing what we call the likelihood that allows to make the nodes all relevant to each other with some relevant outputs, which are, in the end, our predictions. And so because of all these complexities, because that involves a large number of computations, we have what we call the restricted Boltzmann machine, when we have to filter the connections between the nodes. And in the restricted Boltzmann machine, all the nodes are no longer connected to each other. Only the visible nodes are connected to the hidden nodes, and vice versa.
Yeah, and it's just a fascinating type of model. I'll give you an example of how it's so different to everything else that we've seen before. Imagine, like, this is the example that we use in the intuition tutorials in the course. Imagine a nuclear power plant, which, you know, generates electricity. So that in itself is a system, is a huge system, which has lots of parameters. You have the speed of a wind turbine. You have the temperature inside the main core of the power plant. You have the pressure in certain water pumps. You have lots of parameters that govern how this facility is functioning. But there's also lots of parameters that are out of your control, parameters that you can't measure, which might be, for instance, the moisture of the soil in a certain location. We just simply, because there's so many things, so many moving parts in this whole system, you can't measure them all at once. Well, what a Boltzmann machine does is it is, and that's why it's called a probabilistic model, is it generates all of these different states of this nuclear power plant just randomly. And then based on your inputs, you're able to tweak the Boltzmann machine for it to be a better representation of your specific nuclear power plant. Not just any nuclear power plant in the world, if possible or impossible. It's, you make it, you kind of like restrict it to, and this is not in any way connected with the term restricted Boltzmann machine. Those are different. But anyway, you restrict this whole Boltzmann machine to being a representation of your nuclear power plant, and that allows you to model very interesting things. And why a nuclear power plant is a good example, because you cannot model all of the scenarios on a nuclear power plant through supervised deep learning, because in supervised deep learning you need a training set, and you just don't have, and it's impossible to have lots of training data on nuclear power plant meltdowns. So if you want to model all the possible situations in which a nuclear power plant explodes, or disasters happen on it, in order to be able to prevent them, you cannot do that through supervised learning just because you don't have the training data. And that is where unsupervised models, for example, Boltzmann machines, come in, and they can really help out with this situation, because they are generating these scenarios on their own at random. And that allows you to go venture into the spaces that have or venture into the scenarios that haven't even happened in real life.
Right. And besides, by giving this example, you explained the Boltzmann machines from the energy-based point of view. Because actually a Boltzmann machine can be seen on two different point of views. The first one is like it's an energy-based model. So exactly as you just explained. And the second point of view is that it's also a probabilistic graphical model. And that's what we focus more during the practical applications.
Yeah.
Definitely. So it's good that students get to see the both point of views.
Mm-hmm. And probably if you want to challenge yourself to something extremely interesting and complex at the same time, in terms of just grasping and getting your head around it, Boltzmann machines are the way to go, because if you can understand Boltzmann machines, is the number of things that you you'll find challenging to get your head around in the space of deep learning are very significantly reduced. Because if you understand Boltzmann machines, then anything else is going to be a piece of cake. So that's a very challenging topic, but it's also worth attempting that challenge. All right, so moving on to final model in the course, the autoencoders. So tell us a bit more about autoencoders. Where does the name come from?
Well, autoencoders are my personal favorites because, well, I don't know if they're my personal favorites because I really like Boltzmann machines too, but I like autoencoders because basically they're quite simple, especially after studying Boltzmann machines. And at the same time, they're capable of solving extremely complex problems. And that's because they're stacked autoencoders. But basically, we implemented a recommender system with Boltzmann machines that can predict binary ratings. And with the autoencoders, we take it at the next level by predicting some ratings that are from 1 to 5. So that which is a more complex problem. And yet, the autoencoders is a more simple problem, because basically, the simple autoencoders is composed of three layers: the input layer that gets the neuron, the observations, a hidden layer that is a layer with a few a small number of nodes compared to the input layer, and we have the output layer. And by putting the observations into the network, we're trying to reconstruct the input observations in the output layer, and that's how it works. And that's how it's called. That's why it's called autoencoders, because basically what happens is a two-steps process. The first step is the encoding step, when we try to encode the observations into this hidden layer composed of a fewer number of neurons. And then there is the decoding step, when we decode the hidden layer to reconstruct the hidden layer into the input layers. So we're trying to replicate the input layer by decoding it.
Mm-hmm. That's a great summary, and that's what I meant when I said that all of these three unsupervised deep learning models, they have their own ways to get around the fact that they don't have the data that they need to look at the real outcome. And the way that autoencoders get around that is they make the input be the outcome that they're aiming towards. And so in a way, they're not purely unsupervised. Sometimes they're called self-supervised deep learning model, because they are in essence supervising themselves through the inputs that they're aiming to recreate as outputs. So it's their way of cheating the system a little bit. But nevertheless, they are extremely, extremely powerful.
Yes.
And I remember during the course when we were creating it, or just before we created it, you were super excited that there was some breakthrough in stacked autoencoders, and you're like, we have to include this in the course. We definitely have to. This is all so brand new.
Yes, and we implement stacked autoencoders. Because basically, a stacked autoencoders is what I've just explained, but with several hidden layers. That means that there are several encodings and several decodings.
Yep.
And that's exactly what we implement. I think we have two or three hidden layers, but then the challenge, of course, is to change the architecture of the model, and that's very fun. Students will learn how to change the architecture of the model to add more layers and to add more nodes, to tune the number of nodes and other parameters. So they will be some sort of artists trying to create some other structures of stacked autoencoders, and that's a pretty good challenge.
And that really ties in with what you said on the first podcast about which was 6 months ago. Can you believe it? It's been 6 months since then.
Well, time has flied.
Yeah, and what you mentioned there was the artist versus the engineer, right? That's what data scientists need to, two categories of data scientists that we're going to have: the artist, somebody who definitely can't be replaced by machines in the near future, and the engineer who's building these things, who's at more risk of being replaced by machines. So this is a lot of this stuff that we're doing here is, and actually I found it very interesting that you were pointing it out in the practical tutorials that areas where students have to, or any deep learning expert or practitioner has to apply their creativity to come up with a new architecture, a structure for a certain model.
That's right. The deep learning scientist is definitely not only an engineer, it's also an artist, because there is no rule of thumb in making the perfect architecture to solve a specific problem. So the deep learning scientist has to make some sort of arts to find the best model.
Yeah, fantastic. And so that summarizes our six models. And while we have a bit of time still left, I wanted to get your comments on the main two tools that we use. So we definitely cover off different things in the course. We talk about scikit-learn. We use all of the standard libraries, NumPy, and so on, because it's a Python-based course. But the two main tools that we use are PyTorch and TensorFlow. So
yes.
TensorFlow is a Google-developed library, and PyTorch is I think Facebook and Jan LeCun developed library. So can you give us a few comments on that? What are the advantages, pros and cons? Why did we use both in the course? And where do you think the world's going? What should students be, or anybody getting into the world of deep learning, what should they be focusing on at this stage?
Okay, so what I think is that first, at the start, when we have to start learning deep learning, I think the best option is to start with Keras, which is a wrapper of TensorFlow.
Mm-hmm.
Because basically, and that's the big advantage of TensorFlow, is that it has Keras that allows you to build some deep learning models with only a few lines of code.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, you don't have to implement the deep learning models from scratch. And that's the big advantage of this. But then we have PyTorch, and PyTorch doesn't have yet a wrapper like Keras to implement deep learning models in a few lines of code. But it's actually, I think, more powerful than TensorFlow, because it can handle even more complex deep learning models. And these more complex deep learning models are the dynamic graphs, because if we go deeper into the theory of deep learning, well, we will bump into the dynamic graphs, which are basically making a deep learning model that is dynamic and no longer static. And the dynamic graphs is a new specificity that PyTorch can handle, unlike TensorFlow. I really encourage students to handle both libraries, because maybe that they will be able to solve some problems with PyTorch that they couldn't solve with TensorFlow. So actually, PyTorch is very recent, so there is still a lot of debate about that. Not only I think it's able to solve some very complex problems like dynamic graphs, but also I think it's very practical, because students will see that when we implement the models from scratch with PyTorch, well, it's actually very practical and very intuitive. Okay, it takes some lines of code, more than Keras requires. But we can see in the end that when we take a step back at what we implemented, it's actually very intuitive and then very easy to change the architecture of the model. So I highly recommend PyTorch for the two reasons. It is able to solve some complex problems, and the very practical side. But then for beginners, I highly recommend I recommend more TensorFlow and Keras.
Gotcha. Very, very good. And I'm very excited that we covered off these both in the course. And so if in the Auto Encoders side of things and Balsa Machine, you even go into things like how to develop your own class and how to use that
in
deep
right.
learning.
Yeah.
So that's very powerful, I think.
That's a big plus of the course. Students will learn the important tricks of Python and the most important techniques, like building classes. Because basically, I'm sure that when they start some projects of deep learning, they will have to implement their own model. And it is actually 100% sure that they will have to make a class. Classes and objects are very important to understand and handle in Python. And I made sure to explain all this and how what's the use of all this and how we can use them to build some deep learning models from scratch.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much for sharing all of that and for coming on the show again. This brings us to the end of today's episode. The one thing I would like to ask you to finalize this show is what is your book that you can recommend to people who are interested in learning more about deep learning?
Okay, so I highly recommend the Deep Learning book by Ian Goodfellow and Joshua Bengio and Aaron Corville.
Yep.
It's actually a book that they can get online in the www.deeplearningbook.org. And so basically, this is a really, really good book, even if they want to go to dive deep into the math and the theory. And it covers pretty much what we discuss in the course, but more on the theory side. So, and it's a very, very, very good book.
It's free, right?
It's free, yeah. Yes. And then I also recommend some other books. Actually, on Facebook, I'm part of a deep learning group where we discuss the latest technologies in deep learning or the latest theory that appears, the latest papers. And regularly, we have some surveys or some questions that are asked in this group. And one of the questions was, what is the deep learning Bible? What is the best book people would recommend? And so, of course, there was the deep learning book that I just mentioned. But then there was also the book, The Elements of Statistical Learning. And that's an incredible book because it will give you everything you need, all the basics you need to really have a deep understanding of deep learning.
Gotcha. All right. Thank you very much for sharing that. I think this was quite an exciting session venturing into the world of deep learning, and hopefully quite a few interesting things can be picked up from what we shared today. And once again, thank you so much for coming on the show. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. I was very happy to be back again.
Great. All right. Well, see you soon. Take care.
Yeah, see you soon. Bye.
So there you have it. That was deep learning for you. A quick summary of all the six models. Of course, there's way many more models in deep learning, but these are the six main ones which we identified and covered off in Deep Learning A to Z. And hopefully in this podcast, you got a quick glimpse of what the world of deep learning is like and what these models, how they're structured and what they can be used for. Personally, my favorite out of all the six is the Boltzmann machine, because it's so cool, just because it has that, as Hadlan mentioned, you can look at it in two different ways. I look at it in through the lens of an energy-based model, and it uses a Boltzmann distribution. Actually, when we were creating the course, we modified the Wikipedia article for a Boltzmann distribution. That was so cool. We modified. So in the course, there's actually a tutorial in the course. We go into the Wikipedia article for Boltzmann distribution and add some text about just one line, but about Boltzmann machine. And it's very close and dear to my heart because of my because what I used to do back in my bachelor's degree with physics. And it is a very interesting way to model systems and use, and the Boltzmann distribution actually is used to model energy-based systems such as, that include things like entropy and like the gas in the room where you're sitting in. The air is like it's distributed according to a Boltzmann distribution. It's taking the state that is has a minimal energy cost. And so that was very interesting for me to learn about and to include tutorials about. So that's my favorite for sure. And I'd be very curious to find out what your favorite is. I know you, if you haven't ventured into the world of deep learning a lot yet, probably this is your first podcast, intro to that world. And it's pretty much, it's going to be hard to decide at this stage what your favorite is, but maybe if you do venture into the world of deep learning one day, I'd be really interested to find out which one of those six models you would prefer the most yourself. And so that's deep learning is definitely a field to be at least aware of. That's where the world is going. As we mentioned in the course intro video, deep learning is what we're seeing is a shift from machine learning to deep learning. We're seeing that deep learning methods are becoming so advanced and sophisticated that just through their sheer complexity, not in the sense of understanding them, but in the sense of how complex the problems are that they can tackle, just through that, they are edging out machine learning methods. You can very easily get, and I think Ben Taylor on one of the previous episodes in the podcast, he actually mentioned this, that you can beat the accuracy of a machine learning algorithm with deep learning methods very easily. So you have to be, for instance, on the MNIST dataset, which is a dataset of handwritten digits, you have to be very, very proficient in machine learning to get an accuracy anywhere above 95%. On average, you probably get like a 90-92% accuracy. With deep learning, you can be just starting out into deep learning and achieve an accuracy of 98% just because it's that powerful, and you just have to code a few lines of code as if you use Keras, as we discussed, as Hedlund mentioned. So definitely deep learning is something to be aware of. That's where all the technology is going. It's in my view, it's the future of data science. So hopefully, you know, this podcast gave you a good overview of what to expect, or you know, the different type of buzz terms you might be hearing in the near future. So there we go. Hope you enjoyed this episode. And make sure to leave a review on iTunes. If you're listening on iTunes, it really helps us out and help spread the word about this podcast. And on that note, I look forward to seeing you next time. And until then, happy analyzing.